Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is TCP Packet Tracing, Part 1. Today's presenters are Robert Poretti Jr. and Marvin Knight. Robert has been with the IBM Corporation for 14 years and supporting the IBM HTTP Server and HTTP plugin for 9 years. He is currently an advisory software engineer with L2 WebSphere application server support. Marvin has been with the IBM Corporation for 29 years. He is currently an advisory software engineer supporting the IBM HTTP server, HTTP plugin, and Edge components. Prior to that, he worked in ISPS development and support. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Robert and Marvin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's presentation titled TCP Packet Tracing Part 1. My name is Robert Poretti, and I will begin today's presentation. Let's go ahead and proceed to the first slide where we will discuss the agenda. Okay, so the agenda for today's presentation, the main focus will be obviously on TCP packet tracing. The first thing that we'll discuss is what is TCP. We'll provide you a general description to give you a baseline of understanding moving forward. We'll also discuss when to capture a TCP packet trace. Okay, we'll talk about the common technical problems that one can encounter that would justify or warrant when to actually capture a trace. Okay, we'll also discuss where to capture a packet trace depending on the network topology. So once you determine that it's important to capture one, the next thing to determine is where to capture it, and that will depend on the network topology being used. We'll also discuss how to capture the available operating system tools that can be used to capture TCP packet tracing, and we will go into that in more detail. Finally, we'll talk about using Wireshark, which is a GUI-based program, to analyze a TCP packet trace. We'll give a general overview of the Wireshark GUI and packet pane. We'll also talk about how to filter a TCP connection due to the fact that packet traces can contain a lot of packets, so it's important to understand how to filter a packet trace to see an actual physical connection to further analyze and review the packet capture. We'll also talk about a basic breakdown of TCP communication flow so that you'll have a better understanding of how a TCP connection works and what type of data from a packet perspective occurs over that connection. So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 3. Okay, so what is TCP? TCP is the Transmission Control Protocol. It's basically a set of rules used along with the Internet Protocol IP to send data in the form of message units between computers over the Internet. So while IP takes care of handling the actual delivery of the data, TCP takes care of keeping track of the packets that a message is divided into for efficient routing through the Internet. So basically, when we talk about a packet, we're talking about a unit of data. Okay, and that unit of data is routed between an origin and a destination on the Internet. When you send and receive data, for example, a web page, the message gets divided into these individual units of data, also known as packets. Each of these packets contains the sender's Internet address and the receiver's address, okay? And then each of these packets is separately numbered. And so you will see that in a packet trace. When we go ahead and show that further, you'll see that each packet is individually numbered, okay? And the packets are basically units of data that are routed between the origin and a destination on the Internet, okay? So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 4. And at this time, I'd like to go ahead and turn this presentation over to my colleague, Marvin Knight, who will proceed with this next section.
Thanks, Rob. So basically, we're going to look now at TCP packet tracing. When do you want to capture it? Where do you capture it? And how do you capture it? Proceed to slide 5, please. When to capture. When would you want to capture an IP trace? You're looking at common technical problems where you might want to gather an IP trace. One of the first things would be an HTTP header problem. You want to validate that your HTTP headers are correct, You want to make sure the information in the client request has valid data or the response is good, or you may be wanting to look at the end of the header to make sure the CRLF is present. So, for instance, you may have a header that is too large in size. It exceeds the size. You get a message in your HTTP server log saying your header was too long. You would get an IP trace, look at your header, and validate the length of the header. Another common problem would be a large post download. For instance, you might have a 1 gig post going on, and the data gets interrupted, and you get an error message in your web server or plugin log. We would look at the IP trace to verify that the data is being sent or it's being interrupted, and we never see data coming in for a length of time, and then it times out. So this would be another reason. You may also get a premature connection close. That would be another case where a timeout may occur. Just a general reset coming from firewall or something may be another reason where you want to get a IP trace. SSL handshake problems. We want to look at the client hello, the server hello, look at the cipher exchange, see if the ciphers are being handled correctly. Some of that is actually visible in your IP trace. So that would be another reason for gathering an IP trace. Slide 6, please. Where do you capture it? A lot of this is going to depend upon your network topology. For instance, if you have a load balancer in front of your IHS machine, which is in front of your web server, which is in front of your application server. So if you're debugging the communication between the client and the web server, you would want to look at this, determine if it's a direct connection, determine if there's a firewall. Based off of that information, you may want to capture the client with an IP trace. You may also want to capture the web server as an IP trace. If there's a network device in between, if possible, it would be good to get an IP trace on that as well. You may require doing something like a sniffer instead. You're looking at the communication between the plugin and the WebSphere application server. If there's actually a connection available where they're on different machines and it's a direct connection, we can gather the IP trace on both machines. If there's only one connection, for instance, the plugin and the application server are co-located, unless you're on an AIX box, you would have to just get a trace on the web server, and you would only see the incoming web server requests. If you do have remote web server and app server where they're not co-located, then we can capture both machines. If you have a firewall, load balancer, some network device in between, then you may or may not be able to capture a trace on that device depending on what it is. For instance, if it's a load balancer, you would be able to get a trace on the load balancer. If it's a network device, you might have to do something like a sniffer. Slide 7, please. Next, how do you capture? In capturing it on the different operating systems, you use the available operating system tool. With AIX, you have the IP trace command. In the presentation, we provide you the man page for the documentation on the different parameters that are available. AIX also gives you the ability to use the TCB dump command as well. You see that listed for Linux, but it's also available on AIX. As I just mentioned, Linux has TCP dump, and Solaris has the snoop command, and finally, Microsoft, you would use either Netmon or Wireshark. Netmon is the native tool that Windows itself provides, but it's not always available as part of the server build that you may have done. It's not a default network component. It's an optional one that you have to intentionally add. So quite often, it's easier to actually download Wireshark and use that as your tool for capturing an IP trace in Windows. Mostly that's due to the fact that you need the install CD to add it back in. Slide 8, please. How do you capture the IP trace? Here we've provided you some examples on different IP trace commands and some of the parameters that are available. The first one we have running an IP trace on the EN1 interface to capture port 80 from a single client IP to a server IP listening on port 80. You see the command is IP trace minus A minus I EN1 minus S client IP minus B minus D server IP minus P 80 trace.out. In this particular command, EN1 is your interface. Where you see client IP and server IP, those would actually be IP addresses. So in your actual command itself, in place of the client IP, that would be something like 9.37.235.29. Likewise, the server IP would be an actual IP address as well. The minus A parameter is telling you not to include ARP information. The minus B is telling you to use bidirectional for your minus D parameter. Minus P is obviously the port, and then trace.out is your output file. In almost all cases, when we request IP traces, we want the output to be a binary output file. You do not want the formatted trace because then you're trying to read something using an editor that's quite cumbersome. You want to be able to use a tool like Wireshark to look at the output, and that requires your binary output file. The next example, IP trace minus A trace.out. That is just a very basic command to capture pretty much everything but ARP information. Rather than doing the minus A, if you wanted to capture everything, you would just say IP trace, trace.out. That's quite useful when you're looking at traces on something like the Edge Load Balancer because ARP information is actually quite useful for us when we're looking at some of those traces. We can use Wireshark to filter out the extraneous information. When the parameters become quite important would be if you have an extremely busy web server and you need to limit the size of the data, and that's when it becomes important to use your different filters on your IP trace command or your other different commands. Last example for IP trace, we're just showing coming in and going out on server IP on any port for interface EN0. And in this case, you see IP trace minus A, minus I, EN0, minus D. Once again, server IP would be replaced with an IP address. Then minus B, trace.out. Slide 9, please. TCP dump, which would be used on AIX or Linux. We have some examples here. In the first example, it's pretty much TCP dump command that's going to capture everything. And the command you see, TCP dump minus S 2000 minus W trace.out. Minus S is the snap length parameter. That's an important parameter to know on each of the different commands. IP trace, the snap-len parameter is a uppercase minus S. For TCP dump, snoop, lowercase minus S is your snap-len parameter. It's important to provide a value for this because by default, your IP trace, TCP dump, and snoop commands truncate data somewhere around 80 bytes, 58 bytes, depending upon the OS and the command. Each one has typically a different default length. If you don't supply this parameter, you won't get the entire packet where you can see header information. 2,000 tends to be a large enough value because it's larger than most of your packet sizes. minus W is just giving you the name of the file, followed by the trace.out, which is the file name you choose. The second example, the only thing different is providing the Ethernet interface information so that you can limit what device you're tracing. The third example, we add in a port filter with a particular IP address. Once again, server IP would be replaced by an actual IP value. Slide 10, please. Here we have Snoop examples. The first one being your basic capture everything if possible, Snoop minus O, Snoop.out. The second one just provides an interface to capture on. And then the third one's providing server IP as an additional filter. Very similar parameters on each of your commands, whether it be Snoop, IP trace, TCP dump. Likewise, on Snoop, the minus S is needed to give you a packet size large enough to actually see data. And common rule of thumb, if you use a value something like 2,000, that will capture enough of the packet that you see everything. Slide 11, please. Here we're showing how to capture with Wireshark. We're only showing Wireshark for the Windows, but you also have the NetMon utility. Like Wireshark, it's also a GUI and has very similar pull-downs. In this particular case, you start the capture with Wireshark using the capture pull-down, and then you either have options or start where you can choose. Slide 12, please. Here we chose the options, and then you have a pull down from that where you select the actual adapter that you want to start your trace on. You would select the particular adapter that's going to have the IP defined to it that you want to trace. Slide 13, please. We've selected the adapter, then you just click the start button. Slide 14. Now, since we were capturing data in real time, which was one of the options on the previous panel, you will actually see the packets being captured in real time. That will just give you a way of verifying it's really capturing what you want. Slide 15, please. Now, you also have the option of limiting via the host name, port, with a capture filter. You can specify that in the filter on the panel when you selected the adapter. Here we show you specifying the host name and then port 443 as a way of filtering out just that particular port and host. Slide 16, please. Then to stop the packet, simply use the capture pull down and select stop. Slide 17. After you've stopped the capture, if you want to save the file so that you can send it to IBM, you would simply do the file pull down, save as, and then specify where you want to save it and give it the file name. It should default to a cap file type, and you simply save it. Slide 18. And now we'll turn it back over to Rob.
Thank you, Marvin. So previously we went through a brief description of what TCP is. We talked about the common problems, when you should go about and capture a packet trace. We also talked about where capture a packet trace depending on your network topology. And then the next thing that Marvin discussed was how to capture a packet trace using some examples from the different native operating system tools. With that, I'd like to proceed and actually start showing you how to analyze a TCP packet trace now that you have collected one. Packet trace is also known as a capture file, and so we'll go ahead and proceed to slide number 19. Okay, so before we begin, before attempting to analyze a TCP packet trace, it is essential to understand the basics behind a TCP connection. Okay, so a TCP connection consists of three things. So we're dealing with one connection that deals with three or consists of three things, okay? So communication between two network devices, okay? So you have a client and a server. Each one has a unique MAC address, okay? A MAC address represents the physical address of a network device, okay? You also have communication between two IP addresses, the source IP address and the destination IP address. The IP address represents the logical address on the Internet Protocol Network. Okay, and then finally, the third thing is you have communication between two ports. You have a randomly assigned port of the device that initiates the connection, typically known as the client. So when a client goes and actually makes an outbound connection to a destination, okay, in this case the server, the operating system will randomly assign a randomly assigned port to that outbound connection. Okay, and you'll see that as we proceed further. The destination, known as the server, is usually a fixed port, such as port 80, port 443, in the case of WebSphere 9089, 443, et cetera. Okay? So just keep in mind that when we're dealing with a TCP connection, which is what a packet trace is, it's showing packets that flow over connections, there are three main components of that connection. It's a connection between two network devices, that each one has a MAC address, each one has its own IP address, and each one has its own port. Okay? So keep that in mind. Very important as we proceed further. So let's go ahead and change over to slide number 20. Okay, so first, let's give a general overview of the Wireshark GUI and packet panes. Okay, so when you open up your packet trace in Wireshark, this is basically what you'll see. There, just a brief overview of the GUI. You have the menu. You have the main toolbar. You also have the filter toolbar, which we'll talk about that a little later on, as well as in part two of the presentation, which will be Thursday. But the three main panes that I want to talk about here is the packet list pane, the packet details pane, and the packet bytes pane. Those are the three main panes that we deal with when we're looking at a packet capture. So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 21, where we'll talk about the packet list pane first. Okay, so the packet list pane. It displays a summary of each packet captured. Remember, a packet is a unit of data. Okay? So each one of those packets that's captured is going to be displayed in the packet list pane. So by clicking on the packets in this pane, and you'll see here where the blue, the packet number 4723 highlighted in blue, any packet you see in blue is the highlighted packet, and you can click on any one of these packets that you desire. In this case, I selected packet 4723. Okay, so by clicking on the packets in this pane, you control what is then displayed in the packet details pane and the packet bytes pane. Okay, so when we're looking at the packet list pane, you select the packet, and you'll notice these columns. So the first column is the number column, the number of the packet in the capture file. This number won't change even if a display filter is used. You'll also see the time of the packet, and that's the time that the packet actually arrived. You'll see the source, and the source is the address where this packet is coming from. Okay? So we know in this case that for, let's say, the first packet, 4717, the source is 9.37.235.185, so that packet came from that source IP, okay? The destination is the address where this packet is going, okay? So in this case, the first packet, 4717, is the number, and the destination is 9.42.135.23, so we know where the packet came from, and we know where the destination is or where the packet is actually going, okay? The protocol is the name and short abbreviation version. In this case, it's a TCP protocol packet. And then the info column is just additional information about the packet content, okay, where you get to see the length of the packet. You get to see some details, whether it's a SIN, an ACK for an acknowledgement, a push ACK, et cetera, and we'll talk about that later on in this presentation. Okay, so let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 22. Okay, so now the packet details pane. That displays the packet selected in the packet list pane in more detail. So when you select a packet in the packet list pane, the details of that packet will show up in the packet details pane. So this pane shows the protocols and protocol fields of the packet. The protocols and fields of the packet are displayed using a tree, which can be expanded and collapsed. Okay? So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 23. Okay, so the packet bytes pane displays the data from the packet selected in the packet list pane. The highlights and highlights the field selected in the packet details pane. And as usual for a hex dump, the left shows the offset in the packet data. In the middle of the packet data is shown in hexadecimal representation. And on the right, the corresponding ASCII characters are displayed. So basically, when you select a packet in the packet list pane, there's details about that packet in the packet details pane, but the actual data contained in that packet is contained in the packet bytes pane. So this is where you actually get to see the data that's coming across in that packet or contained in that unit of data, also known as a packet. Okay? So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 24. Okay, so now we're looking at the three panes again. And I just want to give you a quick breakdown. Remember I told you that when you're dealing with a TCP connection, it consists of three things. And that's basically what we're looking at here. So you can see here that I selected packet number 6 because packet number 6 is the one that is highlighted in blue. Okay? So as you can see here, you can see the date and time of the packet arrival. You can see the MAC addresses of the source and destination in the packet details pane. You can also see the IP addresses of the source and destination in the packet details pane. And then finally, you can see the source and destination ports. So in this case, you can see that the source port for packet number 6 is 3571. Again, it's a randomly assigned port. Whenever a client makes a connection to a server, the operating system on that client machine will randomly assign a port to that client to make its outbound connection. In this case, you can see the randomly assigned port is 3571. If you look at the destination port, you see that it's a fixed port, port 80. Okay? If you look at the packet bytes pane, you can see the actual data contained in this packet, and as you can see, it's header information. Okay? So this is showing a get slash request, and what we're looking at in the packet bytes pane is the actual data where you see all the header information. So packet traces are excellent for being able to validate header information by looking at the packet bytes pane. Okay? So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 25. Okay, so now that we've given you a brief overview of the Wireshark GUI and the various panes, now we're going to take it a little step further. Okay? Again, a packet trace or a packet capture is basically a series of packets. We're looking at packets that are flowing between different connections from various clients and whatever machine that you're tracing on, okay? It's very important to understand that you need to be able to filter each TCP connection to actually take a closer look at the communication that's taking place. So since TCP packets contain many TCP packets from different MAC addresses, IP addresses, and ports, those three things make up a connection, it is important to understand how to filter the trace when needed to see the complete communication for a single client and server connection. So I'm going to go ahead and show you how to do that next. Let's proceed to slide number 26. Okay, so the very first thing you do when you bring up your packet capture, as you're looking at it, if you see a particular packet of interest, and we'll talk about more on how to determine what packet to investigate further in part two of this presentation, but for right now I just want to give you a general overview of how to actually filter the connection. So once you find a packet of interest, you would highlight it and you would right-click on it and click on Follow TCP Stream. Okay? Once you do that, go ahead and proceed to slide number 27. Once you do that, Wireshark will automatically filter out that entire connection. And what you will see is the follow TCP stream window that will automatically come up when you follow a TCP stream. And what you will see now is all of the requests and responses that were handled over that single connection. Okay? Requests are always going to be recorded in red, and the responses coming back will always be recorded in blue. So keep that in mind. It's a quick way when you're looking at the follow TCP stream window, you can quickly identify what the request is and what the response is. And this window will contain all of the requests and all of the responses that occurred over this single connection. Up in the filter display window, you will see the actual filtered connection information. Okay, so we'll go ahead and look at that next. Proceed to slide number 28. Okay, so here you're looking at what we've done is we've taken an entire capture. We found a packet of interest. We right-clicked on it. We did follow TCP stream. As soon as we did that, the filter stream window came up, showing us all of the requests and responses that occurred over that connection. And if we look at the filter, we can actually see the details of that connection. So what we're looking at here is we know that we're looking at a TCP connection that took place between IP address 192.168.0.10 and 129.42.58.21. And we know that the source port, in this case, the client port, was a randomly assigned port, is 3576, and the destination port, the server port, is a fixed port, port 80. We also can look at the packet details pane and see the MAC addresses for those two devices. And again, we see the IP addresses and the ports listed in the details pane as well. Okay? So that's basically a breakdown of how to filter a connection. Again, in part two of the presentation, we'll go into more of the debugging. What does all this mean now that we've actually filtered a connection? But it's very important as a baseline to understand when you're looking at a packet capture, you need to be able to filter the connection so that you can look at it more closely to see what's actually happening. Okay? So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 29, where we'll go over the summary and a breakdown. Okay? So now that you've seen how to filter a TCP connection, it's also important to have a general understanding of the sequence of events which take place over a connection. This understanding is vital in logically following the conversation between a client and server. Okay, so that's what we're going to talk about next. So let's proceed to slide number 30. Okay, so now that we have filtered the connection, let's go ahead and talk briefly about what's taking place over this connection. The very first thing that you will see is a SYN and a SYN-ACK. Okay? These are used to establish the actual connection. So the first thing that you'll see from the source, in this case the client, okay, you'll see the client sends a SYN. Okay? That is to establish the connection. If the server is willing to accept the connection, it will respond with a SYN-ACK. Okay? And then the client will respond with an ACK acknowledging that it has received the SYN-ACK back from the server. Once you see those three packets, that is an indication that the connection is now established. If you do not see those three packets, then the actual physical connection has not yet been established. You cannot have data flowing over a connection until it's actually been established, which makes sense. So to get the establishment of a connection, you have the SYN coming from the client, you then have the SYN-ACK going back from the server, and then you have an acknowledgement packet coming back from the client. You now have a connection. Once that happens, you can now, or the client in this case, can now start to send data. Data is typically broken up into push-ACK packets. So here you can see in this particular case we're looking at a POST request. The client is sending POST data broken up into different units of data, also known as packets. If you look at the packets, in this case, I've highlighted packet 49519. If you look at the packet details pane, you'll see that it is a push-ACK. Okay? Typically, when a client or server is actually sending real data, meaning a GET request, a POST data, body data, etc., it's going to send it as a push-ACK. Okay? When the server side receives that data or the client side receives that data, the client or server will respond acknowledging receipt of that data. So in this case, we see that the client side is sending push-ACKs containing units of data, and the server in between receipt of these packets is responding with an acknowledgement back to the client. Okay? All right, so let's proceed on to slide number 31. Okay? After the data has arrived, so we have the SYN, the SYN ACK, and the ACK, the establishment of the connection. We then have push ACK packets coming, which is actual physical data. We have the ACKs going back, acknowledging receipt of those packet arrivals. Once communication is finished on this connection, each side needs to close the connection. Okay? So a normal closure of a connection starts with a FINAC, either from the server or the client. In this particular case, the FINAC is coming from the server. So the server is notifying the client that it's closing the connection. Okay? The client side responds with an ACK, acknowledging that it has received the FINAC. The client side then responds with its FINAC, closing its side of the connection, and then the server acknowledges that, and the connection is now gone. And that is why it is the very last packet that you see. Okay? So we've just taken you through an actual TCP connection from start to finish. This is what a normal communication looks like. Obviously, if there are problems with the connection, the behavior may be a little different. You may see resets instead of normal FINAC closures. And again, we'll talk about that more in the debugging presentation to follow, which is part two. And that will actually be held May 26th, this coming Thursday. So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 32. Okay, so here is a brief summary of today's part one presentation. We provided a description of TCP. We listed some of the common technical problems that would warrant gathering a TCP packet trace to help with debugging. Again, more on debugging will be covered in part two. We made suggestions on where to collect the TCP packet trace depending on the network topology. We provided examples of the available operating system TCP packet capture tools for the different operating systems, Solaris, Windows, AIX, and Windows, etc. We walked through the Wireshark GUI and packet panes. We demonstrated how to filter a TCP connection. And then finally, we gave you a breakdown of TCP/IP communication flow, which was explained today. So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 33, while we'll turn the presentation back over to Joseph.
Thank you, Robert and Marvin, for a great presentation. At this point in time, Jackie, we would like to open the lines for questions.
Chuck Beach, your line is open.
Yeah, I just wondered if there's a command for the HP operating system that we could use to gather this data.
There is. It's called Nettle.
Nettle?
Yeah, Nettle. Also, Wireshark has a version that will also work on HP UX.
Great.
So if you go to Wireshark's website, you'll see that they're offering a HP UX version.
Great. This was a great presentation, guys. Thanks.
Oh, thank you.
Our next question comes from Herman Hubler. Your line is open.
I hope you can understand. First of all, thanks for the great presentation, the good introduction, the packet tracing. Actually, what I'd like to ask if you can give us some more details about WinDCAP, because if I'm not mistaken, on Windows, you have to install WinDCAP first before you can use Wireshark. So what is actually the WinDCAP layer doing for us, and isn't there any OS function providing the same capabilities?
I think he was referring to WinPCAP itself and how that is involved in the Windows.
Exactly. That's exactly the question. WinPCAP, basically.
Yeah. I couldn't tell you that off the top of my head without doing some research, so that's probably a good question to follow up with email. WinPCAP is obviously used as part of Wireshark because you have to install it. When you do the Wireshark installation, I know we actually use WinPCAP within the Edge Load Balancer as well as part of the APIs that we use. So it's definitely important, but as far as the actual details on it, we'd have to research it a little.
Okay, thank you.
And we have no further questions.
Thank you, Jackie. I do have a question here through the group chat. And so this question from Christopher is, I have a question regarding slide number 9, using TCP dump DST parameter. Is it possible to use a partial IP address like 10.153.2 to capture all communication to the network, so including 10.153.2.1 and 10.153.2.3, etc.?
Okay, if I understand that correctly, he wants to use something like a wildcard to capture a range of IPs by just supplying a portion of the IP?
Yes.
I don't know off the top of my head. I've never tried that myself. I don't know if it will take a wildcard. Probably something that's best tried as an experiment. We could certainly look into that to see if it would work. I think Rob's looking it up on the man page now. I don't think the man page actually clarifies that, but we'll check real quick. I believe it just states to use an IP, right? If he sends us an email, we can try and get back with that. My first thought would be that it's only going to take the IP specifically and not handle a range, but I wouldn't rule it out. It's something we'd have to research and see.
Sure. Thank you, Rob. And at this point in time, we will conclude the presentation.